And we're back to Keep It with Ira and Lewis.
I was going to say, what's this dynamic like? Are we comfortable now that it's really just the two of us?
No one's ever heard that before.
No, I know. This is a brand new concept to them. Wait, Ira and Lewis just speaking? Will they reference a lot of things from the late 1990s?
Wow, what an episode to start off on, right? We get rid of our woman.
Yes, and lo and behold, yeah. Skoda said, now's our chance.
Yeah, Aida's gone. Aida's gone.
I don't even mean to make rough jokes about this, but yes.
Yeah, we'll leave that to hysteria, because none of my jokes about women are funny.
I have to say, I really love that specifically on this network, there are so many podcasts that have to take the brunt of, one, speaking seriously about things, but two, kind of having to make jokes about really serious things, whereas we just make jokes about, can you believe Shawn Mendes dressed like Gaston? Like, that's all we have to do.
And then there's the show that has to make jokes about everything. Love it or leave it.
Oh, right. Well, he's my favorite stand-up, as you know. So that's his job.
I'm excited, you know, for our new, whatever this is, era.
Yep. It's like the moment in Destiny's Child before they hire, Michelle. Though we're just going to live in that era. I do not mean to compare Aida to Farrah Franklin, by the way. I did not mean to do that.
Wow. I'm trying to think of trios that became duos.
Yeah, does that exist? There was a time when the Dixie Chicks, the two sisters, Marty McGuire and Emily Robeson, released an album called Courtyard Hounds, and I did listen to it twice. I don't know if that excites you in any way.
Absolutely does not. maybe we're just Chip and Dale.
Oh, Rescue Rangers, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I'm probably Chip.
Who's wearing the Hawaiian shirt in that scenario?
That's Chip.
Okay, yeah.
Dale is the more Indiana Jonesy, serious one.
Well, let's talk about who can wear patterns. That's you. So,
yes.
Whereas I'm likelier to do a more solid, rugged approach, I think. You know, I think I treat my own life like I'm Tomb Raider. My life's like a one-player game. This is code for I don't really date.
I also think that Dale would be a good Halloween costume for you to mix into your repertoire of three.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I suck at Halloween, so I will take any recommendations. Last year, I nailed it with Guile from Street Fighter, but that was the first time I really ever took a swing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could buy it all on Amazon within 48 hours, like green tank top, army pants, and dog tag. It was really simple to contrive.
And then I think people were shocked that you didn't go as Kylie Minogue from Street Fighter.
Well, I do appreciate that role. Well, actually, it's a similar costume, really. It would be like a blue tank top or something, but obviously that's yet to come. And also the problem with Street Fighter is a lot of the time, if you're picking that as a Halloween costume, actually you're wading into cultural appropriation somewhat seriously. So those are two characters where it would be fine.
That's fair. Street Fighter is a lot of different cultures that I do not think are maybe properly represented.
Are
by
you
Capcom?
Saying? Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't think there was an inclusion officer making sure everything was running according to, you know, protocol.
There's a lot of exoticism. There's a lot of orientalism. There's a lot of weird representations of everyone from Africa has stretchy arms and big hoop earrings.
I was going to say he's from India, Dalsum, and the juxtaposition of yoga with I'm setting people on fire. I don't know. I'm going to read up on that Encyclopedia Britannica article, but I don't think those two things go together.
I think my actual favorite part of Street Fighter games is the background characters who have two movements that they shift back and forth from, and they're just in the background cheering whenever any fight's happening. But then there's usually just a lot of women with big breasts.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of horny men grabbing at them too.
No, you're exactly right. They kind of look like the inflatable things you see at a car dealership, and they're like waving their arms, and it's just, can you imagine just looking at a fight on the street, which is what this game is about, fighting on the street and just waving in the distance.
I've noticed that that is one of your favorite cultural references, by the way. Like, how many car dealerships do you drive by every day?
I'm from the unglamorous Midwest, so let me tell you, the answer is many. And I used to live right by the Brand Boulevard of Cars in Glendale, so it's ingrained. Mm.
All right. Well, speaking of glamour, we're going to talk about the Met Gala this week.
Which I was paying attention and enjoying it, and then it just fell right the fuck off, which I can't remember in recent... Well, I guess it's like the Oscars. You know, it was just... It was going. Everything
and
was going
Will
according
Smith
to... Will Smith... Right.
...stormed into the Supreme Court.
And slapped us back 50 rights. Years. Yeah,
yeah, right. Slapped abortion rights away. We will be talking about the Met Gala, despite the insistence from... You know, self-important people online who think that we should only ever be talking about one thing at all times.
That was incredibly annoying. Again, did anybody say this about any sporting event, that all the people should quote unquote leave the arena and go to DC or whatever people were saying? It's this, there's this like resting shame about, honestly, famous women enjoying themselves. And that, but then people saying, well, they should stop what they're doing and leave. It's like, you're not saying this about literally any other thing. I don't know why you're doing this, but for some reason, you want these people to feel bad about themselves.
The restless shame, though, is also on the part of the person talking as well, though.
Yes,
I feel
right.
like people also feel ashamed of themselves for caring about something that they consider is stupid. And so they have to reflexively sort of point out that they're not being stupid by showing that, hey, I care about this thing that just happened, which obviously, you know, there was a leak from SCOTUS that they are making a decision to, you know, sort of get rid of Roe v. Wade. A thing that also will not be going into effect until around June. It's only a draft, but, you know, it's sort of like ground zero here for all of our rights being taken away. But there is something about the fact that this news dropped in the middle of the night because it was a leak. And right. so no one was anticipating this. So when people are getting mad that the Met Gala is trending higher than, you know, this SCOTUS leak, do you know how internet algorithms work? Something that just came out a second ago is not going to be trending higher and have more posts than something that people have been talking about all day.
Right. And all week, right? You know, like yeah. leading up to the Met Gala. Yes. Also, who even believes what they see on a trending bar? I don't know about you. When I look at, well, I'm on Twitter, but like, it'll be like, guess what's trending? Kate Blanchett. I'm like, no, it's not. You just know I want to talk about that. They just throw up names now.
My favorite topic, Roe v. Wade, is trending.
Yeah. The girls are lit.
So yeah, we're going to discuss the Met Gala this week. We're also going to talk about... gay shit from our youth, inspired by the new Netflix series Heartstopper, which uh-huh. has sort of like brought up, I guess, feelings of, you know, gayness that we've had from when we were kids. You know, we're going to talk about the new Real World New Orleans reboot with one of our iconic gay heroes, Danny. And this whole Abercrombie documentary out, White Hot, on Netflix as well, which also had me thinking about like being gay in the Midwest in the late 90s, early 2000s. So a whole childhood trauma episode.
Yeah. Frost your tips, put on those puka shells, let's roll.
And if that's not enough, we are joined by the very delightful Amber Ruffin to talk about what it's like writing for a late night show, hosting your own late night show, and also writing the book for a Broadway musical based on Some Like It Hot.
Is that not mind-blowing? Of all the leaps this person could take, she like jumped right to Tony frontrunner.
All right, we'll be right back with more Keep It.
Check out Crooked's new show, Hot Take,
On the latest episode, hosts Mary Anais Hegler and Amy Westervelt sit down with climate reporter Kate Aronoff to talk about what the heck nationalization means and how it may hold the key to saving the planet from global destruction. New episodes of Hot Take drop every Friday wherever you get your podcasts.
Monday night, the Metropolitan Museum of Art hosted the Met Gala, the annual fundraising event where no one knows how to Google what a theme means.
I'm going to say, also, so it was mainly American designers was like the umbrella theme, but Gilded Age was the sort of theme within the theme. And guys, we had a whole television series you could have referenced. It's right there in the title. It says Gilded.
Yeah. Part two of In America, an Anthology of Fashion. The theme was Gilded Glamour and... I don't know. First of all, this was a wild ride. It was a wild ride of taking in like bad costumes, and then some people who like understood the assignment, and then also the SCOTUS leak happening at the exact same time. You know, it was very disorienting for me because I'm in Amsterdam right now, and you know, so I'm like. I couldn't sleep really. So I was like, I went to sleep early while like the Met Gala stuff was still happening. And then I'm waking up and getting all of this news. And it's like 4 a.m. here. And my mind is just like fried.
You're just like Vincent van Gogh. You're in Amsterdam and your mind's a blur. And
it felt like a fever dream. I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Well, it was indeed a starry night. Oh my God, I need to stop. Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to cut your ear off, Lewis. here's the thing about the Met Gala, which happens every year. There's always the conversation that, you know, this is a parade of capitalism and it's rich people, you know, who don't care about the rest of the world, etc. And, you know, that was highlighted, you know, I guess with the events of the SCOTUS leak, but also the juxtaposition of them just because they were happening on the same night literally makes no sense.
Yeah.
Like one doesn't inform the other. And you were right when you pointed out that like when something like there's always a capitalistic event happening in America, which is a capitalist nation. So anything and everything could be happening, you know, but I guarantee when this draft was leaked, you know, it had nothing to do with SCOTUS getting together and being like, well, let me tell you something. America's going to be distracted by the fashions tonight. So let's draft this memo. What probably happened is it was a Monday.
Right.
And people go to work on Monday.
Right.
I know the internet generally hates Mondays. It has this whole sort of like Garfield-esque thing where they're like, oh, Monday, don't talk to me about work. I'm ignoring emails. But some people do go to work on Monday. And sometimes people go to work to take away our rights on Monday.
Do you think the Met Gala should move to Sunday for this reason? Because we don't want to intersect with abortion news ever again. And it only occurs on a Monday.
Yeah. Maybe so. The first Sunday in May has sort of a ring to it.
Yeah, cute. It's very Kentucky Derby. Now, okay, let's get into the people who arrived. You know who I am so thankful always comes? Because, in fact, I think she's the definitive Met Gala celebrity.
Rihanna?
Sarah Jessica Parker. Rihanna.
She obviously wasn't there because she's, you know, about to give birth in Barbados.
Right. No, Rihanna, she's like a, you know, she's like the Olympics. She comes every few years or so, and then you can't always expect her. But Sarah Jessica Parker, she came in this sort of, I'll call it Harlequin-looking, me describing fashion is, by the way, lol, this Harlequin-looking dress that actually evokes the Gilded Age.
It was Christopher John Rogers. I love this look on her. It is a far cry from that one year she came with like a fucking birdcage on her head.
Right. But also, it's like she knows the level you're supposed to bring in terms of grandeur. Because I feel like too many celebrities go for sleek or like, there's no other way to put it, like normal glamour. And like the Met Gala is supposed to be a little bit of a step outside of reality. And I think that Sarah Jessica Parker is the one who definitively always goes for it. And also she has the vocabulary. She probably knows more about fashion than all the other celebrities put together.
I'm just going to get this out of the way. My favorite look of the night was Sebastian Stan and Valentino.
No, wait. Your favorite look of the night? Girlfriend, you would wear that.
I cannot get... I know I can. Louis, thank you.
Okay.
It's so... First of all, it's such a good look on him.
This is an all-pink outfit. Yeah. It's very, like, just south of bubblegum pink. I would call it, like, a bright magenta.
He's looking like bubblegum pink. He looks like a Batman villain.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's something just so sexy about it, and I like that he looks great. You know, it's not on theme, but it feels like it's in the spirit of the theme, if that makes sense. It's not just him wearing a pink suit, you know? Like, it feels opulent. Anyway, I like it. I can't get it out of my head. But also, as I said, I was on Xanax taking all of these looks in while also taking in the hell of American politics. So forgive me if this was my favorite look. I would maybe give it to Blake Lively, but I feel like everyone is overhyping that dress.
I feel like Blake Lively, who was a co-chair of the event and wore this sort of literally gilded, like a brownish, greenish, huge gown with his sort of pictures all over it. Lovely and huge, but also expected and ultimately just charming. I wasn't getting rad from that dress, which is sort of what I like out of. And it was meant to evoke the Statue of Liberty and how it was, you know, built with copper and then has that greenish tint over time, etc. Great, but not quite rock and roll, and I like that little X factor of something naughty going on. Nothing was really naughty about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only thing really naughty about Blake is that she got married on a plantation.
Oh, I think, yes, that's true. And then I have to give it up to Ryan Reynolds for kind of just standing there. I mean, he was not commanding attention in any way, and I think among straight men, nobody likes attention more. he's got like vaudeville eyes. Like, I'm ready to be funny. So you had Sebastian Stan in all pink, and yet you've said nothing about Glenn Close wearing the same color, sweeping in.
You know what?
Is it because you're a sexist?
It is, actually.
Got it.
You know, unfortunately, I'm not a closer.
That was Kira Sedgwick, but okay.
I was trying to come up
you
with
are
a name
damages.
For,
that's what you are.
I was trying to come up with a name for Glenn Close fans, but I guess I should go call my mother and ask her for a different one.
I'm having a hillbilly elegy for your taste, I have to say.
I think Glenn looks great. I think Glenn is sort of in a class of her own right now. We're just like, Glenn is doing Glenn, you know?
Yes. Also, her hair looks fabulous. She has a very sleek, what we once upon a time would have called a Susan Powder look. You can Google that. But I thought there were not very many celebrities of Glenn's ilk. Like, Christine Baranski showed up for the first time. That was cool. And she swanned in her, I own 51% of this company garb, which as she should. But there weren't many, like, Ariana DeBose was there, but not much in the range of Oscar winners, I didn't think, showed up this time. Honestly, the caliber of celebrities was a little flat for me.
I mean, everything lately has been giving, like, B-string celebrities, unfortunately. Like, not, like, you know... It's like Coachella, the attendees, you know, it's like the Oscars this year. It's just we're not getting the A-listers. Where are
yeah.
they?
I'm like, where was someone
J-Lo?
Like
for a, planning her wedding?
J-Lo. Where's someone like Cher? You know, like those kind of people. I know where Madonna was. She was performing with Maluma, and we actually can't talk about that because I can't bring myself to watch.
Yeah.
Maluma directing her around on stage, guys, don't even Google it.
You know what? She loves surprise performances on stages where she terrorizes a young male rapper.
That's true. I know you're referencing Drake right now.
Let's just get this out of the way and talk about Kim Kardashian.
Great.
And this Marilyn Monroe look that everyone won't stop talking about. First of all, I want to say Lee peed at home. I'm fine with her getting dicked down by him. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, you should be able to do that, baby. You're 41. Enjoy it. But she looks like she is chaperoning him every time he's on the red carpet. Like, what's going on? Like, his just like his suit and glasses look. I'm like, that's not going to become a thing. We're not doing this. We're not doing this. And you are 41 years old, also giving interviews about how basically you starved yourself for 3 weeks to fit into this damn dress.
I was sort of surprised to hear that until I saw her. And honestly, I don't think I even recognized who was Kim Kardashian for a second. To me, I thought it was J-Lo. Like, she looks much different. Also, I have to say, historically, I like that she's referencing the Marilyn Monroe dress because, I don't know, it's a little bit witty. You know, it is, it's Americana. People can't stop bringing up Marilyn Monroe, but it's not the first reference you think of when you think of Marilyn Monroe. She didn't come down in the Gentlemen Prefer Blondes dress or anything like that. That said, it's a remarkable dress for the time, but on the Met Gala red carpet, I didn't think it was particularly stunning and, in fact, sort of was flat to me.
Also, it's from 1962.
Right.
Girl, like, the Gilded Age didn't last 300 years.
It's, my favorite era in American history is 1858 to now.
See, I like when people, like, listen, this is going to be weird coming off of, like, the Sebastian Stan thing, but, like, I like when people aren't on theme and do something interesting. What I actually dislike is when someone decides, like, I'm going to make a historical reference that actually has nothing to do with the historic moment that we're actually celebrating. You know, I'm like, you can wear this honestly anywhere and to a bigger moment, and I get that it's the Met Gala and you want all cameras on you, but you're Kim Kardashian. All cameras are on you if you go to Citgo.
Right. I think maybe her hair choice, I think, also made less of an impact.
Didn't even give us the full Marilyn. Like, what the fuck? It's lazy.
Right.
It's lazy. I don't know. I still can't get over the whole, like, not to be Jameela Jamil here, but, like, giving an interview about how, like, you just, like, starved yourself for 3 weeks to fit into this dress. I'm like, girl, you're at home raising kids. Like, this, and, like, this is basically just, like, her selling those lollipops again. And then... She changed into a more comfortable replica after she walked the carpet. So I'm like, it's a scam. It's a scam. Right. And Jameela was right.
Because the dress is like gossamer thin and is currently owned actually by Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Orlando, which if you're going to go to a Ripley's Believe It or Not, you must go to the Orlando location, I have to say.
Well, speaking of Ripley's Believe It or Not, Shawn Mendes.
I believe it. It's what he always does.
You know what? He looks good.
No, he's obviously gorgeous and the epitome of an Abercrombie type guy, which we'll get into momentarily. But honestly, so he dressed in a sort of, I would call it like a dandy coat, like a slightly military vibe. But the only kind of opulent part of it were that there are big gold buttons and there's a red sleeve, which is as much as he can handle. I think
he looks like Gaston.
Yeah, he looks like Gaston, right?
Here's the thing. I agree with Tom and Lorenzo. I think they called it mad that it's basically just sort of like aspirational fashion, which is like a lot of guys, like, which gets into the Abercrombie thing, right? Like, the suit looks like, honestly, like, I think you would look good in a suit. I mean, you know, it's not like you rarely step over into, you know, what I would call fashion.
Move it along. Go ahead.
You know, I've never really seen you turn what I would call a look. You know, I've never really been impressed.
But okay.
I would say.
Thank you for writing that poem about how I dress. Go ahead.
But I think that you would look good in this, you know. But then that also brings you the question of, like, if it's the Met Gala and if it's a dress, an outfit where it's like, oh, this looks really great. Like, let me go and find, like, a version of this. Like, are you really delivering?
Right. I just think it's sort of in line with Shawn Mendes going with pleasing looks and never interesting look. Like, he really has a problem coming up with interesting. Musically, anything he says, like, maybe on the Who Weekly message board, they casually refer to him as Yawn Mendes, and I'm sorry to laugh every time.
Even his, like, little notes app screed was so uninteresting. I was like, sis, what are you talking about?
Oh yeah.
I was like this is a bad journal entry. I was like, I don't even get what you're saying. Ooh, what are you talking about?
Recently he posted something on NotesApp about, what was it? He was like feeling alienated or something.
Just about feeling sad.
Okay. And he has like the noted anxiety problem or something. So, okay, fine. Go ahead and do that, but his anxiety did not elevate his look, I have to say. I wish he were even a little bit more anxious and gave us more.
Yeah, join the Zanny family, baby. I have anxiety too, and I love popping a Zan. Okay? I pop one before I do this show.
This is your second time today. You're a drug addict. Okay. Now I know.
Last thing about his fashion and you, I actually really love his hair, and I think you should start doing that.
My hair runs a little tussle. Yeah. Texture and my hair meet every couple years, but I will do my best to achieve that.
I really liked model and First Nation activist Quanna Chasing Horse, by the way, because like she paid tribute to, sort of like indigenous people during that era.
Oh, no. When people, Cynthia Erivo did that too, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
She's
looking great in Louis Vuitton.
Also, I forget that when Cynthia Erivo speaks, it is arresting. Like you cling onto the wall and just listen to the like butteriness of her incredible just speaking instrument as opposed to just her tremendous singing voice.
Some other people I thought looked great. Like I thought Jenixa Bravo looked great. I thought Emma Corrin looked great. Venus Williams looked like she would look great in a boardroom.
I was going to say, Venus Williams dressed like Whoopi Goldberg in Soap Dish. this is barely a reference to anything other than looking good in 1991.
She's the baddest bitch at the Women in Music Business Conference.
So, Sharon, I'm a bitch. Yeah.
Shout out to her. I think everyone is in agreement on what the absolute worst look at the Met Gala was.
Oh, it's got to be Camila Cabello?
Camila Cabello. What the fuck was she wearing?
It was...
You can see it in her eyes. You see it in her eyes. She knows. And I am so upset by this because let me tell you something. Her new album, Familia, is actually really fucking great.
I'm not surprised by that. I've historically enjoyed her music. Yeah, the dress looks like everybody made the same joke. It looks like an Is It Cake funfetti thing. It was like it has this ruffle that was patched with what I'm going to call fruity pebble specs. And it just looks super cheap. It looked like a Project Runway Gristidis challenge where she took a roll of like candy dots and turned it into a dress.
She looks like the Terminator that came back from the far, far future to tell Dippin' Dots about their future. She's a Dippin' Dot Terminator is what she is.
My favorite thing about Dippin' Dots is that they always have the potential to be right. It still could be the ice cream of the future. We're not there yet. You know who did look amazing and was wearing, I think, the designer of the night? Michelle Yeoh, our friend, wearing that mint green Prabal Gurung dress, and I believe also Mindy Kaling wore that. Just gorgeous. And also, I love when somebody is wearing a color that nobody else is
wearing.
Well,
Michelle Yeoh's was gorgeous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mindy's was giving, fine Golden Globes gown.
It looks like a Golden Globes gown. Actually, you know what? I need Mindy Kaling to fire her makeup artist, and I'm just going to put that out there.
Well, it matched the gown, right?
Yeah, yeah. I love sis. I want her to do well. I don't like the makeup. What's going on here?
I've got to say, monochrome.
There's a bad mua. Let's get somebody black on the team.
I think monochrome in general looks better on men than it does women. There's a stolidness to monochrome that befits masculinity. I believe in the binary. Did I not say that? Okay.
Well, I only wear makeup that goes by they, them pronouns. So okay, I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay,
lastly,
they're a mess.
Lizzo looked great as well. But you know what?
And she brought the flute.
Yeah, I've had it. Leave the flute at home.
That is sort of like 2016. Yeah,
it was wild that she brought the flute with her because I was like, we still doing the flute?
Yeah. It's like if Alanis Morissette brought a harmonica wherever she went. It's like, yeah, I remember you played it that one time.
Right. You know, it's like if Justin Timberlake brought Chris Kirkpatrick with him everywhere he went. Okay. Like,
that would be kind of cool.
There was a time and a place. There was a time and a place. Okay. Let the flute join Celebrity Big Brother and go on its way.
In a 7-2 vote, flute, you are eliminated from the Big Brother house. The flute walking on out, hugging its friends.
All right. When we're back, we're joined by the very, very wonderful Amber Ruffin.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two-fourths of the British podcast No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
She is a writer on Late Night with Seth Meyers, the host of The Amber Ruffin Show, the best-selling author of You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey, Crazy Stories About Racism, and she's doing far too much, and the writer of the upcoming Broadway musical, Some Like It Hot.
Which, what?
Please, please welcome Felicia Rashad. No, obviously it's Amber Ruffin. It's Amber. Imagine if I was like the host of the Amber Ruffin Show, and then it's just like
Kiki Palmer.
Felicia Rashad. Eternally grateful to be a thrill.
There is so much that we can talk to you about, and we'll talk to you about. But first, we're going to get right into Some Like It Hot, a musical that you are working on because, first of all, I never knew I needed this in my life. And now I really need it in my life now that I know about it. And you're writing it with Matthew Lopez, who wrote The Inheritance.
Yay.
So tell us about how you even got involved with this project and what's it like working with, you know, Matthew, who just came off of writing a 20-hour queer epic that was on Broadway and the West End.
Yeah, I mean, it was the most fun. I just couldn't believe it. Like, usually we write little jokes and maybe Seth Meyers will say them. Sometimes it's like some celebrity somewhere. And that's the biggest deal that's going to happen to you. But man, you write all these little things and like professional Broadway actors say them and it's different. It's something different. Yeah, it was neat to learn how to write for like a giant stage. Because even like a 300 seat theater is not a Broadway theater. Like it's different. So every little bit of writing you've done, it will be called upon, you know, to help you figure out how to fill a Broadway theater. It's very cool. But yeah, Matthew Lopez and Casey Nikoloff, the man who directed a million things on Broadway, including Book of Mormon and Aladdin, and the team of music writers who wrote, among a million other things, Hairspray, are doing the music. So they all called them. We're like, do you want to help us write this show? And I said yes, but they had already written quite a bit of it. You know, that's the journey of a musical, is they rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it. And
this
so
team, iconic, by the way.
Yes!
I mean, basically they called you up and were like, hey, would you like to win a Tony?
And I said, yes, whatever you need, I'll do it. I love it. Yes. But yeah, it's very cool. It's cool.
So, I mean, let's talk about Some Like It Hot, just period. First of all, I feel like in my life, there's been a general, I've been seeing a lot more Marilyn remembrance material, namely about just what a brilliant comic performer she was. But that movie, so much of it holds up, the speed of it, the jokes are so good. So how will this show call to mind that movie, or how will it be completely different from that movie?
It'll be completely different in that of the five main characters, one is white. Okay. So that's a big change. And also, we just didn't want it to be so problematic. So we had to shake all the dirt off it, which was, you know, just an excellent exercise in writing. It's like this show that really, you know, everyone over, I'm going to say 60, 70, is like, this is the funniest movie of all time. And you're like, well, yeah, but maybe it's the funniest movie of your time and today. So, yeah, we went through some work to fix it. And, you know, just, I guess I shouldn't say fix, but I definitely super will now a third time fix. We had to make sure everyone who came to see it could have a good time. And now I can 100% say, when you come and see it, you will have a good time and you won't feel like we're ragging on you, which was my only goal.
Some Like It Hot is in my favorite genre of films, by the way. People disguising themselves to escape the mob.
Right.
Just like Sister Act, right. Connie and Carla. And yeah, I mean, because, you know, the director of it, Casey, the Drowsy Chaperone is like one of my faves, you know?
Oh,
so
yes.
I imagine you're updating the jokes to sort of, I imagine the musical has to be self-referential, you
yeah.
know? Like, you can't do a musical from the 50s without sort of acknowledging that, like, the concept and, like, the jokes and everything are, like, you know, a bit dated, and then making fun of them. Do you enjoy that kind of comedy? You know, did you find that you were flexing a different comedy muscle than, like, what you do on your own show, which is already different than what, you know, the skills you use on Seth Meyers?
Yes, it is all a different type of comedy, and it took some getting used to, like a mug, but it is so, I don't want to say broad, but like physically broad, like mm-hmm. the hook is you're writing comedy but for a cartoon. That's probably the closest I could get. Like, once my mind was like, this is cartoonish, we want cartoon laughs, it was a lot faster, easier to do.
Speaking of comedy muscles, I'm curious what the difference for you is between writing material for Seth Meyers and writing material for your own show. Because it feels like to be a correspondent and then also the main act feels like you're necessarily going to have just a different demographic audience. And do you feel that when you're writing material for both shows? And is one tougher than the other, for example?
I used to always say, no, it's the same. And we, you know, I fucking sit down on Sunday and I write, and whatever goes, goes, and I don't give a rip. But yesterday I wrote, and I came up with this thing. And I was like, I don't think I could do this on late night. And it was like something like the FDA is going to ban menthol cigarettes, which brings us to a segment called, is this racist? Like, but then, like, if I do that on the Amber Ruffin show, it's fine. But if I do that on Seth's show, it's just a little, like, it doesn't feel great for white people to be like, ah, those black people and their menthols, I can't get enough. You know, that feels gross. But I wrote it and I was like, oh, this is fine. And then when I said it out loud, I was like, oh, yeah, we can't. I don't know that that's the right thing to be doing. So yes, I finally found it. Yes, there's definitely a difference there, because the difference is, just like you said, where were you a while ago? The difference is who is the audience. And that's something I was never keeping in mind because I'm bad.
I mean, it's so exciting too to see you having your own show, you know, where you, you know, get to be a Black woman in late night, you know? Like, I mean, what's it been like, I guess, sort of for years working and being in Seth's voice for so long? I mean, what was it like developing your comedy muscles over the years on that show? And what maybe have you sort of had to, I don't want to say unlearn, but like something where you're like, oh, okay, I don't have to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I started Seth's show, I just was like, man, shut up. Don't embarrass yourself. Try and keep it together. But then I quickly found out that there were no rules. And like, I don't know how to say this. You could, you know how when you are Black in a workplace, mm-hmm. that you have your own set of rules and then everyone else has their own set of rules? The second I realized, I don't think these people know Black folks are supposed to have their own set of rules. They, you know, and then we're all like fucking digging around so bad, like leaving, go have a steak in the middle of the day and a margarita, come back and be like, well, we are fucking around. There were no rules. And they're just like, haha, you guys are fun. And we were just allowed to do whatever we wanted as long as we came up with fun, you know, sketches and fun bits. And it was all like, you know, camaraderie and, you know, party time. And then, you know, once I realized, oh, I can also be acting like these people, I thought, I wonder if this extends to what I can do on the show. And I'll be damned, it certainly does. So I showed up there and be like, hey, these are haircuts I hate. Here they are. People are like, yeah, what are you gonna do? I couldn't believe that I got the latitude I got. And then I just started pushing it. And I'm still pushing it. But yeah, for my show, I had to realize, like on Seth's show, he's the straight man and I'm a lunatic. And then on my show, it's harder to be the lunatic. So I just ended up doing what Seth does and having my writers on to be silly sweethearts. And it works and it's funner that way. But yeah, I didn't know that. I thought, oh, my own show. Now I'm the king of the idiots. But you can't really do it like that. If someone else has to be your doofus. It's fun.
Now, I read this and I was shocked not to know it from the time I knew who you were. You were the first Black woman to be a late night comedy writer. Is that correct?
All of the things you have to say in order to make that true. It's like, yeah, like the first Black female writer on a late night network talk show. I don't know, man. Like, I don't know if that's true.
I do think about a show like Letterman. And I'm like, oh yeah, maybe there wasn't a Black woman on that show. Now that you mention it, you know what I'm saying?
I'm sure Jack A was writing jokes for, you know, the Johnny Carson show. We just don't know about it.
Yeah, right. Surely Joan Rivers for a moment. Yeah, had someone, you know. But I mean, like, were you aware of that at the time when you got hired for the show? Like, no. Anything statistically about that?
Absolutely not. And then I also didn't even think about it. And then someone wrote that article and people were like, oh my God. I was like, well, what do you expect? Like, I certainly never was like, I'm going to grow up and do late night. It never occurred. Never. Not even for a minute. Not even while Arsenio Hall was on. I was like, oh, good for this man. I love it. It's a great show. I love it. Y'all look like you're having fun and I enjoy that. But like, it certainly never seemed like an option to me.
Did it not seem like an option because it was something where you were like, this just isn't the kind of comedy I like to do? Like, you were like, I like improv and this, or was it just like something you didn't think was possible?
No, it was something I didn't think is possible. I love late night and I love like presentational variety sketch. which is what I like to do. Like, not like sketch, like Black Lady Sketch Show or I Think You Should Leave Sketch, but like Carol Burnett. Like, we are talking to the audience. You know, I'm laying out my character very early, you know. That's the type of comedy that I enjoy. So, like, corny.
But I think we can call that classic. Yeah.
Oh, thank you for the rebrand.
Yeah.
Lewis made the Hayes Code over here.
Yeah, right. But I mean, like, I have to say, like, you writing this Broadway show is, I mean, I guess the word is inspiring, because you just literally, I mean, it seems to me you have just leapt from one complete comedy world to another. Do you have a third in mind? Do you have, like, ambitions still that are outside these bubbles? Or does that feel, it's crazy that would feel inconceivable, because getting to write a Broadway show already feels inconceivable.
Yeah. It's all, like, I have never sat down and been like, these are my goals.
Yeah.
These are my wants and my wishes and my, you know, I certainly was never like, I'm going to end up on TV. Like, even in my mind, I was like, I'm going to move to LA and I'm going to give it a shot because I have to. But even like, that's where the thought stopped, was like, I'm going to try it. And then I had all these safety nets and was like, oh, okay, then I'll do the Second City cruise ships, or I'll go back to Boom Chicago, or go teach improv in Chicago. And that was how I thought of it. I never thought of the, what if it goes? Fucking never occurred to me. Never occurred to me. And still, and then with every new thing, I go, well, it's not going to get crazier than this. And then it does. It does. So I'm not saying shit. I'm not going to say one word, and I'm just going to let whatever happens happen, because I couldn't have guessed it. If I had tried to guess at every point, I would have been wrong. So I'm not saying anything.
So Some Like It Hot came to, was brought to you. If you could think of a movie that you love, like one of your favorite comedies, like what would you want to adapt? Like, what do you think like would really pop on stage?
Thank you. And this is what I've always wanted to do. I want to do first of all, I wrote a musical based on the documentary King of Kong. King of Kong is a documentary where two men vie to become the Donkey Kong arcade game champion. And one is a pure soul, a science teacher who is a doll baby. And then the other guy is almost the devil. They're just real people fucking loose in the world. And it's the best documentary I've ever seen. It's not even close. And I wrote a musical about it with my friend Lauren Van Curen, and the music was by David Schmoll, who does all my music for my everything. And it, you know, we took it around and it won awards and we did this and that. And then the people who made the documentary saw it and were like, stop it.
Oh, they can do that, huh?
Yeah. They were like, the two of you can do this musical every once in a while for fun, but not for money. You can't like drum up a big tour and shit. And I'm like, okay, I won't. But it's only because they want to write a King of Kong musical. I think that's in the works, but whatever. It'll be the second best one. I guarantee it. That thing was the shit. But my point is, first of all, that is the best. It's the best. It was a two-woman musical where we played each character. It was just like a quick change karaoke musical. It was the best. And then because sometimes you have meetings with studios and they go, what movie do you want to turn into a musical? And I say whatever I think they want to hear. But the real answer is over the top.
Oh my God, the arm wrestling movie.
The arm wrestling movie.
Yeah.
I think that would be the absolute best musical of all time. It's so silly. And I don't think anyone has done, like, people remake movies, but I think it would be a good idea to remake a movie that takes itself just as seriously as the movie did when it came out, even though we now know that that is stupid. Like, that's what I want to do. I want to do over the top. Those people were like, in life, you got two arms, one for love and one for dealing out venture. I don't even know. I'm making that up. But like, they say things like that, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
I mean, first of all, that's iconic because it gives me like Cobra Kai vibes, for one. And two, you can't go wrong like making a musical with based on a movie that had a Giorgio Moroder soundtrack.
Oh, please.
So, you know, it is, you know, I'm sure it's not one of the most listened to ones of his, but over the top, the music did what needed to be done.
The music was so beautiful. And there is this theme that goes throughout the movie. And every time I see it, I click on it, so we watch it. But like the driving theme, the dun 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 oh, but I've seen the movie so many times that I sing a full silly song to that track. But also, that's what makes it seem like it'd make a good musical is. That score is unreal. It is completely overpowering. It's nuts. And I love it. But that's how things were in the 80s. It's beautiful, and I'm right.
Love yeah, you throw Kenny, you throw Kenny Loggins on a soundtrack in the 80s, and you know, you're done. So
No, I have because of the new Top Gun, I've been reacquainted myself with Take My Breath Away recently. And like that is, I mean, it's a wonderful song, of course, but it really takes you on a sonic journey for a movie that is, you know, not that deep.
Yeah.
Another Giorgio Moroder classic. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that exactly what Gaga's planning to, you know, the new
right,
song
yeah.
from Maverick? It's like, it's this epic song. And it's like, the movie's not that, it's Top Gun 2.
Yeah. No, wait, why have you seen this movie a million times? It seems like, was it just on TV all the time or what?
There was a period of time where it was that and Overboard on TBS every Saturday.
Okay.
Iconic
movies.
Like, yeah. It's like, I love this.
TBS airing only movies with over in the title, by the way.
They were doing it
over Fridays, whatever it was called. I don't know. I mean, remake Overboard into a musical too, unless that's happened already.
I'm pretty shocked. I don't think it has. It had that movie remake,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I feel like, but I also feel like Over the Top is safe, but a movie like Overboard, you would be like, oh, let's make this into a musical. And then you find out that, like, they had a run of it in, like, Cleveland or something in
right.
2001.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I but we are so excited for Some Like It Hot, I have to tell you this. Yeah. Because I truly just love a musical like that. I think it's like, you know, like I said, Drowsy Chaperone, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Like, I love a musical that's sort of referencing, you know, the comedy that was in the original film, and it feels like it's doing something fresh with the material. And you sound like a perfect person to be doing that, Amber.
Yay! It's good, man. It is very good.
Oh,
They started running through it, I was like, oh shit, you forget people can do this. Like throwing each other around and shit. I'm like, I don't care for this.
I'm so fucking excited to see Christian Borle. You know, I've seen him in I'm obsessed with Little Shop of Horrors, one of my favorite musicals. So I've gone to see different iterations of this current run every time there's a new Seymour, and just seeing him, you know, as the deranged dentist in that, he's so good.
Yeah.
So
he's fantastic, and it's so cool to be like, hi, Christian, would you please say these lines, please? Okay, goodbye. I love him so much. It's terrifying.
Yeah, he's a stone pro. I mean, he should just be in every show. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Amber.
Yay!
What a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
Yay! Thank you for having me. This is fun. And each of you is more perfect than the last. And I love your show.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you. We adore you.
Hey!
The Amber Ruffin Show is streaming on Peacock, and her book, You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey, Crazy Stories About Racism, is available in bookstores everywhere. But maybe not in colleges, because I hear it's critical race theory. When we're back, Lewis and I talk about our teenage gay trauma.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two fourths of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
All right. Every faggot online is talking about the Netflix coming-of-age romance series Heartstopper. And you know what? It's good. It's really good.
I would say it's cute.
It's cute. I do have one big complaint.
Which is?
That's all you give Olivia Colman to do?
It is mind-boggling that Olivia Colman is on this show. The woman has 7 lines altogether. I want to be clear, she's nominated for 3 Oscars, and one of them was yesterday.
I see Olivia Colman in this lovely series, which was like adapted from a webcomic and graphic novel, about this boy, Nick Nelson, who starts to figure out his sexuality and realize that he is attracted to guys. And that comes when he starts a friendship with this boy, Charlie, on the show, who's already out and gay at their high school. But baby, like Nick, struggling with his sexuality, played wonderfully by this actor, Kit Connor. These actors, Kit Connor and Joe Luck, most of the actors in this, seem to be this is their first role.
Yeah, and they all did really well. Nobody's acting really bothers me or anything.
But you cast Olivia Colman as the mother of a teenager who's figuring out their sexuality, and I'm thinking there's some juice coming.
Right.
There's something coming. I feel duped. I feel like Oprah on the couch with James Fry.
No, I kept thinking, oh, surely this is leading up to a coming out scene where he comes out to Olivia Colman, his mom, and Olivia Colman turns to the window and says, now I have a story to tell you about a time in college where I had a wonderful thing with a wonderful woman I never saw again. No, she literally just turns to him, and I guess I shouldn't spoil it, but here's a spoiler, turns to him and says, oh, thank you for telling me. I'm sorry if I ever made you feel like you couldn't tell me that before. That is it. That's what Olivia Colman does in the show.
Yeah. This was her moment to wipe Michael Stuhlbarg out the fucking room, okay? Yeah, to wipe the fucking floor with his Call Me By Your Name speech.
No, Jennifer Garner in Love, Simon, she should have been vanquished, and yet nothing.
It is wild that Jennifer Garner's role in Love, Simon was more emotional than Olivia Colman's role in this.
No, it's mathematically, it makes no sense.
It was beefier. We giving the beef to Sydney Bristow? I love that we're giving the beef to Sydney Bristow, but come on, give Olivia Colman something to chew. It's actually wild because she has 7 lines, but She has more lines in Heartstopper than she did in The Lost Daughter.
Right. Well, that was a lot of trembling and crying. So, yeah.
And still, it felt lacking.
Right.
I needed some trembling and crying here.
Right. No, nothing. She was utterly stable. It made no sense.
She showed up on set one day.
Okay, let me say this about this show, though. It's basically a Nick Jr. show about boys kissing. I mean... I don't want to say it's anesthetized because it is an emotional show, but they really simplify and virginify the idea of coming out. Like, it's not a sexual show in any way, not demanding it has to be or whatever, but
no.
Just know you're getting a very, very sweet version of a high school romance. And additionally, some of the choices made to color in the emotion of the story are pretty fucking juvenile. One,
sweet. There was, you mean like the animated flowers that fly around people whenever they have feelings for someone?
Excuse me. Let me explain what happens on this show. When two people are in a scene and they make even a light romantic glance at each other, the show is not content with you picking up that they're having a romantic moment. It has to tell you they're in love with each other with literally cartoon birds and butterflies flying in and like ramped up music cues. It's literally like teaching a one-year-old what being gay is, which great, glad we have that. But based on the fact that they're high schoolers and based on the fact that we are thinking adults, we can deduce on our own what's happening without SNL Saturday TV Funhouse graphics flying across the screen.
Eureka's Castle held your hand less in scenes, is what I want to say. But this critique is only a critique, I think, of the audience, of our peers who were taking it in.
Yeah,
because this show, I feel like, is very cute. I mean, clearly Olivia Colman being in it probably helped it get made. So
yeah, maybe that's
shout
part
out,
of it.
So
I
shout
no
out
idea.
To that. If it's just your kids consuming this, if it's just teenagers who haven't come out, if this is their glee, well, maybe I do feel a little sorry for them because this show is no Glee.
Okay? I don't know about that. Glee at least gave you some cynicism.
Okay, I mean, listen, Yasmin Finney, gorgeous trans actress, by the way, who plays Elle on the show. I follow her on Instagram, and she is a bombshell. She could be giving us, like, Naya Rivera in Glee, but instead they've got her in, you know, like, glasses looking like Anne Hathaway in the beginning of Princess Diaries.
Right, no.
So, when you look at how gorgeous this girl looks IRL, you're going to be shook. By how they dress her up on the show. But I'm just like, when a show like this comes around, there's always the moment where like gay men in their 30s, specifically our age,
yes,
will consume it and then go on this whole thing about how like if only we'd had this when we were kids, you know, and talk about like how emotional it is to them and how good and perfect it is and how they're watching it, how they've watched it 6 times in the weekend alone. And let me tell you something, that is ahistorical. We did have this when we were kids.
Broken Hearts Club. There's tons of movies like this. Like, I mean, Edge of 17. Yeah.
What's also different is that, I mean, it's different in the sense that, like, this is, what, like, 8 episodes that are half hour each. It's very easy to digest. And it's about, you know.
And it's really well produced, I'll say
it's
that.
It's really well produced. It addresses bisexuality. It addresses trans kids. That is great. But in terms of the story that's actually moving cis gay men who are being emotional about it, it's the main love story. And, you know, like, we got that shit on, like, Dawson's Creek. We got it on, like, Buffy, you know? And
Undressed Motherfucker.
Right? Yeah. It had a lot more drama, and it had more, it felt just slightly more real, you know? Like, Googling, am I a homosexual on a BuzzFeed quiz is funny, you know? But, like, he would have Googled, he'd have known he was gay by looking up gay porn before that.
Right. Well, it's sort of like you're hearing from that sector of Ted Lasso fans who are constantly saying things like, it's just nice to watch something where everyone's lovely. It's like, okay, kind of, but it also sounds like you're emotionally deranged. I don't need it that much. Yeah.
Which is to say, I enjoyed the series. Did I cry during the final episode? Yes, I did. But here's what I will say, that there is something just sort of like emotionally stunted about, you know, always finding a piece of media like this and being like, I wish I'd had this when I was a kid, and sort of like overblowing the, you know, obstacles that you faced in high school just so you can feel good about the fact that you cried watching this Netflix series.
Yeah, right. Well, people love announcing that they cried at something. It's like, they think it's like an ultimately, like the most humanizing thing you can do online. It's a little bit of a performance. But anyway, I just want to say, I obviously was a bit critical.
Which is very weird, because I used to cry during nothing. And then it turns out I cried during animated movies all the time. And the first time it ever happened to me was watching WALL-E.
Oh, did I cry during WALL-E? I do remember specifically being in the theater during WALL-E, and at the beginning, maybe when he puts the Hello Dolly thing on or whatever, I remember having an emotional reaction, being like, God, Pixar, like, literally reaches into your brain and touches the spot where emotions are. Anyway.
No. It's not easy to make me cry. I should probably be on Lexapro, but...
Right. Oh, yeah. I was going to say, I do really like this show, and I think it's fun to watch. Also, it's like candy. It slips by. It is also the most cyan show in history. The coloring on this show is just... They took crayons or colored pencils and made it the most Easter-colored show of all time. So, like, even just aesthetically... You're in a real happy bunny-like place. Now, we must get into the real world, New Orleans homecoming.
Okay, so this was our gay youth, okay?
Yeah.
Danny
the year
Roberts,
was 2000, yeah.
And Danny Roberts in New Orleans with his blurred-out boyfriend in the military was that. That is what, like, made my, like, heart race as a kid.
Well, one... Nobody was more Abercrombie looking than Danny from this season. So he was a very specific type of very cute model smile. And also just like he was sort of like delicately nice. He wasn't just he didn't actually have like a ton of like personality. There was almost like a
no, he wasn't.
There was a sense that he was introverted. That's what it was. And
yes. He was not like any other gay character that we'd had on MTV before. Like I'm thinking of Dan from Miami.
Right, who was just sort of in your face.
He was a cunt.
Yeah.
I mean, to put it, he was a cunt.
And he talked at 500 miles per hour, yeah.
Yeah, and like basically ripped Melissa to shreds over opening up his mail.
Right. But was generally like the comic relief in the house too, whereas Danny was not like that. But what's interesting is, so this is a Paramount Plus show that reunites the New Orleans cast of The Real World. Every other cast member, even... Tokyo, who is formerly David from New Orleans, as he calls himself now, their personalities came right back to me. Like Kelly, who's married to Scott Wolf, I'm like, wow, you are the exact same. It was actually, in a way, validating for the art form of reality TV because they reminded me of my other impressions of them. Melissa was exactly the same. She was still hilarious and still withering and righteous.
Hilarious and also... There was a sense of growth with all of them, too, in the sense that, like, Melissa is, yes, very hilarious and, like, righteous, like you said, but she's also taken in the fact that she doesn't feel like she did enough to represent herself, like, as a brown girl on television in 2000. And obviously she understands, like race and society, like, a lot more than, like, some of the other cast members. So, like, she's funny, but she also feels like... relevant and like current in the same way that she did in 2002.
Also, I mean, I think she is acutely aware of the fact that Julie on the season, who is this religious Mormon girl whose whole like, it was like the season was like a Bildungsroman for her. Like we were seeing Julie really get acquainted with the real world. Like she was like the star player, like the, mm-hmm. The virgin. And then it was basically someone like Melissa's job to give her the education. So in a way she was a tool to elevate the character of Julie. And I think this
Man, is she exhausting.
We'll get into that in a second. But I think Melissa realized she's like, I'm not going to do this show if I'm just going to be a tool to advance this other character. And now she's like, I think fully, her own character, not just somebody who's there to, pick at the idiocy of somebody else. But my God, Julie, who looks exactly the same, most of them look exactly the same, was just a drunk mess, a horny mess. And she's like married to some guy at home. I was shocked at how quickly she went back to being a classic Real World cast member.
Yeah, and also just like a villain.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Just like she was propped up in this way in 2000. Now she comes back on the show and it's very much like making her discomfort at being like white and then also like a terrorist to everybody during the show and after it, like their problem. Because she wasn't just awful to them on the show. Like Like they revealed that like she like fucked up bags for them after the show too, like fucking up, like saying bad shit about her other cast members to like for speaking gigs and shit like that. And what it also reminded me of the fact is that these were celebrities.
Oh my god!
When
yes.
like, no, and maybe
if I was in college, if I was in college when these Real World casts were on TV and they came to my college, I would absolutely drop everything to go see them.
I remember when I first moved to New York and they were shooting like Back to Brooklyn, like they were shooting the Williamsburg season. We went crazy when we saw like them filming in Union Square, you know, and like that was 2007 still, you know. And for me, I think that. Probably because MTV was like created its own ecosystem where, you know, like it was sort of like a precursor to Instagram and Snapchat, you know, where like everybody can become a celebrity now, right? And like in reality TV stars are become less celebrities now unless you're like, you know, the cast of Selling Sunset or something, you know, on like a huge global you know, scale reality show star, because like there's so much reality, like it's the celebrity is diluted now. If you're a Real Housewife or you're on a Netflix show, like then you become huge. But MTV, I would sort of compare to like an Instagram or a Snapchat, because MTV created its own reality, basically, in the sense that they were celebrities, but they were also on every MTV show. They would appear like on like Spring Break, or they'd appear on TRL. And it's sort of like if you were famous on MTV, you were famous in the real world as well, but you were mostly just mega famous to the audience that watched MTV every day. Does that make sense? Like, they were our biggest celebrities.
Yeah, they gave you plenty of opportunities to continue your fame elsewhere on the network. Yeah.
Yeah, and that they were the biggest people to us, the way that like, you know, someone's like favorite like Instagram influencer is like the biggest celebrity to them.
Right. I want to say also about Danny from New Orleans on this season. He's the one person who doesn't remind me of the person he was on the show before, and it's interesting to see, because I don't think you often get a serious glimpse of someone after they've experienced, you know, the rush of being on a reality show and the rush of fame when they aren't prepared for it. The trauma he went through is on his face. You can see it was not easy. That also, it's like when we had Peter Page from Queer as Folk here, the original Queer as Folk here, I said to him, I was like, man, so I bet people come up to you every day and tell you harrowing stories of their queer, whatever, teenage years. And he goes, that happens to me every day. That is so fucking much for somebody to have to deal with. And Danny clearly was one, I think he's thankful that he was, could be, you know, a beacon of hope and for all these viewers. But at the same time, that is so much to bear. He talked about how he became a hermit for years and years. I was actually surprised to hear that his relationship with this Paul guy from the military went on for years after the show. I didn't remember hearing that at the time.
I wouldn't have been shocked if they'd broke up like sort of immediately after the show.
But, right. Yeah.
Also the trauma of like being an out gay man on television, but also still essentially in the closet because your partner can't be publicly out.
Right.
And now you're a different person now too, because like you've had the trauma of people coming up to you. And then you've also had that relationship that was basically like how people knew you on TV. And also like, not to be crass about it, but it's also like, imagine being like a fucking gay person on the real world and having to live in the shadow of Pedro.
No, right. I mean, also, the show does a really good job of pointing out that if you were like an out gay celebrity in 2000, I mean, you were in a league by yourself. There just weren't that many new celebrities who were out and gay. You know, there were kind of like established celebrities who could begin to come out, you know, in the vein of an Ellen, etc. But there weren't many, you know, it was still like pre the era where someone like Perez Hilton would want to out you, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just, there was not like a textbook about how to be an out young gay celebrity, let alone somebody who was just like an average citizen for most of his life up to that point.
I mean, and that gets us to White Hot, the rise and fall of Abercrombie and Fitch, which basically describes that era where you still had no idea that there were like other gay people like you in your small town. Like, you know, like you that was still sort of the era of being gay, like pre AOL, pre, you know, like gay people being everywhere, that you could still feel like, maybe I'm the only gay person in my high school.
Right.
Which is absolutely not fucking true. Anyway.
Completely. No, I guess this would have been a little bit post the era of AIM, but when I was in college from 2004 to 2008, I remember going back to my hometown and being like, oh, like when things like a Starbucks would appear or an H&M would appear and suddenly gay people were working there. It's like, that was like the closest thing I had to social media then. Like, oh, there are other gay people here and they've found this place where they can work and sort of be gay and look gay, you know?
And the idea that, you know, we just hadn't gotten into conversations about struggling with your sexuality, even sort of in the way that, you know, like getting back to Heartstopper, the character Nick Nelson, realizing it actually was really sweet to see in that show a character coming to the conclusion that they were bisexual. Instead of just like, oh, like I'm gonna like pretend that I like girls and then just be, you know. Anyway, it was nice to see that, because it reminds you of the fact that like everybody deals with their sexuality in their adolescence. And I think that during this period of our like high school lives, like in your brain, you're just thinking, I'm gay and I don't want other people to find this out, right? At no point did I in my mind think like, oh, by the way, there's another classmate who maybe isn't gay, but is dealing with the fact that like they're attracted to their best friend. And what does that mean? You know, like there's no concept of the fact that like there's other people going through the same struggles that you were going through in high school, through the same degree, a lesser degree, a stronger degree. And I think the documentary sort of gets into that in the sense that like the Abercrombie ads were basically like light gay porn, but no one noticed that they were light gay porn because it was selling this aspirational frat shirtless white bro running around like either naked or just in jeans, which looking at it now, anybody would look at that now and be like, this shit is gay.
Right.
Back then, it looked like it's just like, oh, this is how straight people want to be.
And they get into the fact that the main photographer for Abercrombie was not only gay, but like this sort of lech who is problematic with models. They get into that. I mean, watch the documentary. But what's interesting is I think people forget, and this was told to me when I interviewed Raja from Drag Race years ago. Mm-hmm. She said that like a reason that Drag Race changed things in a way was not only did it repopularize drag, but it sort of officially led gay people out of the Abercrombie era of their place in pop culture. What happened is like gay people became obsessed with preppiness. That became like the gay look. And I think Abercrombie was a big part of centralizing that, you know? And so now I look at those pictures and I think, wow, it really looks like, I mean, to be frank, all the porn I consumed when I was like 17 or 18.
Yeah. I mean, that is the direct, like Abercrombie is the direct pipeline to Sean Cody.
Right. Yes.
You know, and it's funny now because like if you go to SeanCody.com now, it doesn't even look like the models that you remember from years ago. You know, it's like the preppy aesthetic is sort of gone from it.
Well, again, I remember very vividly in about 2005, there was an entire genre of porn that I would describe as skater. Like everybody had... there would be you had to wear you started with Vans on. That was the rule. But I want to say about Abercrombie, I actually, what's interesting is as much as it was the cool brand, you know, around the time when that LFO song came out, I never shopped at Abercrombie. But mind you, I was sort of like unaware of fashion. I think I got into Express for Men eventually. I wanted to look like the gayest cast member on Whose Line Is It Anyway?
And nothing's changed.
Right. I'm still wearing my lilac dress shirt tucked into like cerulean jeans.
What's weird about the aspirational nature of that is there's this one black woman in the documentary who discusses being a part of like the class action lawsuit. And she talks about, you know, the being at school, when she transferred to a new school in DC, is like the school that like Chelsea Clinton and all of like the Obamas and people, Obama's kids went to, about that's where she discovered Abercrombie, you know, and her, she just describes conversations with her mom where her mom, like once the class action suit like started happening and when she was fired for being black, you know, her mom was like, that's what I always assumed this was. You know, but like when you're a kid, you just take into account like what other people are doing. And it's like,
yeah,
when I was at a public school.
Yeah, no context. Yeah.
When I was at a public school in Milwaukee that was all black, I wanted to wear FUBU, you know, because that's what the kids were wearing, you know, like a FUBU, Nautica, Tommy Hilfiger, you know, like I was around black kids. I wanted to wear what the cool kids were wearing. And then when I was transferred to, you know, and I, when I went to an all boys high school in Milwaukee, I would say that's sort of where that sort of like preppy Sean Cody aesthetic sort of started for me, and why I would even start to be attracted to that in that period, because that's when you see the Abercrombie shit and it's all there. And it's weird. I think that like if I had never gone to that school, like would that have ever happened to me, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it's not like I shopped at Abercrombie because I was not Abercrombie size in high school, but like you would still walk past it and feel this like sensation of like maybe going in once or twice and like half perusing, being like, oh, would I fit this? Can I do this? Or just because you just want it to be like a weird part of it. But weirdly,
well, also that show, that store did such a good job of cultivating intrigue. As they point out in the documentary, it was the one store that ever put up brown shutters outside so you couldn't see in it, but they had posters of models on the outside and occasionally real life models on the outside to sort of let you know this is a whole world and not everyone's invited, but I mean, I guess you could take a walk through and maybe see if, you know, you're cool enough to hang, basically. Like, it was just, there was an allure there. And also, of course, you could hear the store and also smell the store. So it just had its own sort of Shangri-La vibe.
But it's also just sort of, I mean, it's sort of Met Gala-esque, right? In the sense of like creating this intrigue of this place that you can't get into and then you're still obsessed with it. But then ultimately, is it that cool? Because it's like that seemed like the in place, you know, and there are these hot guys out there. It's like, what's going on inside this, right? And then when you become like an older gay person, you're sort of like, those people wouldn't even make it past like the bouncer in like a hot queer New York nightclub.
But it's like the intrigue they cultivated was very suburban. It was very like, here's the idea of a popular person in your school or college that you can kind of replicate, that you can kind of buy into, you know. It wasn't like a Hollywood glamour. It was very regional, shall we say.
But very Aryan.
Oh my God, it's the whitest thing ever. Yeah. I mean, literally, that I remember. You would go to any other store in the mall and you would see people who weren't, you know, totally white. Whereas Abercrombie, as I remember it, might have had one person of color in it, and then everybody else looked like they were, you know, a cast member on the OC.
When we're back, it's Keep It. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis, what's your Keep It this week?
Okay, I'm going to bring up some Met Gala stuff that we ashamedly forgot. And you're going to be mad at me for the name I'm about to say. But let's talk about what happened with Jared Leto at the Met Gala, which is to say, everybody thought he was this other guy named Frederick, some model, who was giving a very I've heard of Bjork costume. It's this shocking kind of black swan colored. It's pointy. I can't even describe it. Go and look it up. But everybody thought it was Jared Leto. And then lo and behold, seconds later, the real Jared Leto showed up looking more traditionally Jared Leto-like, with a designer looking exactly the same. And I just want to say already that is too much discussion about Jared Leto and being confused by Jared Leto. Because guess what? I was watching the E! Red carpet treatment of the Met Gala, and I heard Karamo live on air say that's Jared Leto, and he was wrong about this man, about this Frederick guy. And
Karamo bad at his job? I'm shocked.
Also, man.
Also, Karamo was wearing a wave cap.
Yes.
And he is bald.
You're like a detective.
It seemed like he was trying to throw off Perot. Okay.
Yeah, that was confusing. I don't know how everybody got this also wrong. The guy, I guess, does look like Jared Leto, but I mean, you've been on red carpets before. They usually yell the person's name. Yeah, before you go out there and befuddle the press like this. It was really, really strange.
And imagine shouting Jared Leto's name and him not immediately responding. If we say it three times, he might show up on this podcast.
Right. Don't tempt him. Don't tempt him. But anyway, it's one of those things where I usually am excited for the Met Gala until I realize it's going to enable Jared Leto, and then my emoji smile fades to a flat line. You know what I'm saying? Secondly, Emma Stone came to the Met Gala, which I did not expect her to. I did not expect to see Emma Stone last night. And she went with boring. It's this sort of off-white, mostly white, slightly flapper fringe on the end of the dress, but it looks like something a girl would wear to her first communion or something. And I need Emma Stone to evolve to not a camp place, but to an adult commanding industry figure place. She needs to not dress ingenue is what I'm saying. I'm done with the Easy A era. I did watch that movie again recently, and it's still a little childish for me. I didn't love it. She was good in it. Mm. But I would love Emma Stone to graduate.
That's still your worst dream.
You think so? It doesn't do anything for me. I think the parents are weird in it too. Lots of weird choices in that movie. Anyway.
Do you like Crazy Stupid Love?
I like the scene where she does an impression of Lauren Bacall in the High Point commercials. Otherwise, no.
Can I say, by the way, side note, I was in London this past weekend, and I met up with a friend that I've known from Instagram for years, Johnny. And he recently discovered Keep It, but referenced the fact that he also recently discovered the Lauren Bacall coffee ads because you referenced them and didn't know them before, and brought up the fact that that scene in Crazy Stupid Love must be so weird for people who don't know the reference.
No, because they don't really explain it from what I remember either. And I brought this up before, I'll be quick. If you haven't seen these Lauren Bacall commercials where she's advertising decaffeinated coffee called High Point, that she says, like High Point, like it's the angriest delivery ever. I would rarely call anything camp. This is certainly campy, certainly. Mm-hmm. But
I've also discovered decaffeinated coffee later in life.
I enjoy it. I just like the taste of coffee. So decaf speaks to me.
When I want coffee at night, I drink a decaf now.
And one of these commercials begins with Lauren Bacall saying, my favorite time of day is night, which sounds like, you know, something the son of Sam writes in a note to you or something.
Bram Stoker's Lauren Bacall. I'd watch it.
Anyway, so Emma Stone, feel free to graduate to like a striking, you know, Azealia Banks like pantsuit or something next time.
You're not going to bring up Amy Schumer looking like she was in The Matrix?
Yeah, Amy Schumer underwhelmed too. But at the same time, like, this isn't an event where I would expect her to be like aces or anything, you know?
She always seems like she's at these events under duress, and yet she continues to show up.
Right. I just want to say, I thought Amy Schumer did an awesome job at the Oscars, and people were so dismissive of the host of that telecast. So I just want to give a shout out to Amy Schumer, really landing jokes. Every joke people were screaming at, and I feel like she didn't get the credit for it. Moving on.
All right. I'm proud of you taking a pro Amy Schumer stance on this podcast. We've had highs and lows with Amy on this show.
But good, you know.
Remember when she had that Keep It knockoff on Spotify the year we debuted?
Honestly, no.
Neither does she, probably. Anyway, my Keep It this week is a bit more serious. My Keep It goes to the entire circus that is the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial. I am so upset every time I see anything about it online, and it actually has nothing to do with either of them or the very horrific details to come out of this trial. My Keep It goes to the way that people are treating this like it is the Patriots versus the Broncos.
Totally.
It's like this is... it's gross all around, and it is so weird how people are acting like it's a football game, like you have to choose sides, like one side is winning, one side is losing, they're keeping score. I mean, these are human beings. And it's also like a really sick situation. And the way people are sort of deriving entertainment from it is, it's sort of vile to me. Like, I don't know if you saw that one video of like a Starbucks where customers were being asked at a drive-thru who they supported, Johnny or Amber. And then like people cheering, like, another one for Johnny. I'm like, oh, now I get it. Now I get how, you know, people sat in coliseums and watched gladiators battle to the death.
No, I can't remember an acrimonious exes trial in recent memory that compares to this for a couple of reasons. One, the details are utterly insane. And it going both ways, like reading texts from Johnny Depp to Paul Bettany are crazy. Amber Heard, but we don't know what her story is. If there are things being fabricated, I'm not here to say one way or another which way I want it to go, as you just said. But also, the intensity of Johnny Depp fans is unparalleled. It is truly up there with the Michael Jacksons, with the birds outside the courthouse thing. There's something about him where people believe necessarily that there is a core of utter excellence that must be defended. And it's like, I too have enjoyed whatever, Sweeney Todd. I enjoyed Finding Neverland. I do not connect with Johnny Depp. I don't know what he did ever. I mean, is it because of Pirates of the Caribbean that people think I have to, like, my happiness depends on Johnny Depp's, on justice for Johnny Depp? And it's extremely strange to behold.
That is such a good point. I would say that Johnny Depp has never really had this hold on me, like never had this chokehold on me the way that he has on his fans. And I get it with Michael Jackson.
You know? Like, okay.
The music, there's no comparison. It's undeniable. I mean, he looked really good in a crop top in A Nightmare on Elm Street. Crybaby is a fantastic film. So is Donnie Brasco.
But also
there is the existence of Secret Window, Dark Shadows, The Tourist.
Rum Diary, where he met Amber Heard. Yeah.
You know, like, there's, for every Edward Scissorhands, there are at least, like, two very abysmal movies within the past, like, decade and a half, two decades. And I'm including every Pirates of the Caribbean movie after the second one.
In which he made 11 figures apiece. Yeah.
That are abysmal. So I can't even really defend the status as, you know, like an actor. As well.
Yeah.
Anyway, the entire theme is just very weird. And it just reveals like the worst about humanity.
Did you hear about how somebody rushed into the courtroom with some makeup packet that would prove that somebody on Amber Heard's side was lying about something? Anyway, the fans are extreme and they're at the courthouse in Virginia. And I hope we never.
Is this
have
how Loving versus
like
Virginia
again.
Was?
That's Ruth Negga is standing by, smiling at a sink on Team Johnny. Yeah.
You know what? The only exes I ever want to see battling in court are Catherine Zeta-Jones and George Clooney in Intolerable Cruelty.
Oh, duh! Please. Ugh. Remember when we used to give Catherine Zeta-Jones roles like that? What a good time for us.
Now all she does is sew pillows for her home line.
Right. I guess in a way, I'm sort of grateful that we have the glamour of acrimony. Like, just, you know, it's been so long since we've had a Zsa Zsa Gabor or an Elizabeth Taylor or whatever, Liza Minnelli. Like, there was something quaint about the tabloidization of a relationship falling apart. But also, this is utterly toxic. So I don't mean to glamorize. I don't mean to revel in the glamour at anymore.
Yeah. If you want to revel in acrimony, Lewis, I mean, Tyler Perry's 2018 psychological thriller starring Taraji P. Henson is right there.
Okay. I'll load that up on Tubi or wherever it's playing.
I'm going to assign you that when we do Tyler Perry blind spots on this show.
Oh my God. Why did I get harried too? From watching Tyler Perry movies. Anyway. And if you want a rundown of the full Johnny Depp Amber Heard story, The Cut has a really awesome and comprehensive analysis rundown of the whole thing. So go to that.
But as I may remind you, it is not Sunday, and Johnny Depp fans should stop acting, you know, like the Christians in a town where a couple of Episcopalians just moved in. Okay. You know, like, there are no sides to be taken.
Right. You don't win based on whatever happens. Yeah.
Yeah. You but Lewis and I can win based on whatever happens. So Lewis is Team Johnny, and I'm
Go get him, Don Juan DeMarco.
That's our show. We'll see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III
and Louis Fertel.
Our editor is Charlotte Landis, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer.
Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Malkonian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week.
If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription-exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcast and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community, is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.